Thank you for listening to Teaching Artistry with Courtney J. Boddy. This is episode 68, Act 2, Jaron Herman, Pockets of Light, recorded December 2nd, 2023.
So damn tired of waiting on a perfect A plus B. The one size fits all prudent kids all screaming about irrevocability. Let's burn some bridges, earn some stitches, and fight our own way free. Cause the rules don't lie, but they don't apply to people like you and me. Let's start it up now. 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 Now they say it's all decided, all divided, all laid out. And the pushcart man with a three-part plan can't understand what you're shouting about. But when the paths they plow, the lives allowed are the only roads you can see. Just remember walls were built to fall for people like you and me. Let's start it up now. Let's start it up now. Let's start it up now. Let's start it up now.
Hey, hey, TA Podians. Welcome to Teaching Artistry, powered by A Space Between. This podcast is research, recorded, and produced on the unceded lands, water, and air, stewarded by the Canarsie and Munsee Lenape peoples in what is colonially known as Brooklyn, New York. Thanks so much for listening and supporting this indie podcast. Invite your peeps, colleagues, and friends to join our global community and subscribe on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast player. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Teaching Artistry Podcast, and head over to teachingartistry.org to access episodes, guest bios, e-zines, merch, and more. I don't know about you, but I am loving this conversation. Oh, golly. I really just love... I have such affection for Jaron. And this conversation, you know, over the course of it, we're talking about disability justice and the disabled community, authentic ins into the disabled community. And during our conversation, I share that I have access needs. I don't say those words, but I'm saying that I have access needs. And I haven't specifically identified as a person with disability, though I do have things, absolutely, and probably, you know, should think of myself as such. But I also allude to my mother, who had osteoarthritis ever since I can remember, and it meant that her mobility was impacted throughout her entire life. Watching her as a kid and as an adult navigate through an ableist society was really real. And yet I, in listening back to this section of the episode, I speak about her, or I talk about her. And as I am, I noticed that I'm using ableist language. And to be really, really honest, like, I really thought maybe I should edit that out. However, I realized that this was a great learning moment for me, one, to acknowledge, but also for me to hear it back and for me to interrogate as I move forward in my work, in my life, you know, as a functioning citizen in this society. I just think it was worth noting this. So in this episode, Jaron shares more about his engagement with the disability community and with disability justice. We also discuss the relationship for him between liberation and artistry, and the tension that of this relationship within the capitalist construct of our time. We also dream a bit, and then we just have like sweetness that we just like share about how we feel about one another, which is super authentic and real. Here is episode 68, act 2, Jerron Herman, Pockets of Light.
The kind of work that you have been doing as a disabled artist, how does this manifest? So you talked earlier about the sort of pinnacle moment or catalytic moment of working with Sean and then being able to work with Heidi Latsky, and that lasted for about 8 years. So in that time frame, how were you engaged in these conversations with your fellow dancers, choreographer, yourself? How is this manifesting and I'm thinking, because this is teaching artistry, like in terms of community-based work. Yeah.
It starts really from choosing a community, not unlike anthropology, that you're going to like just focus on and to be among them in a way that, you know, increases the amount of information you'll gain. So it was not only through sessions in the studio, but through breaking bread, walking from A to B, visiting other people's homes, being on the subway with them, just in context wherein I learned what it meant to do this work outside of the performing of it. It was really important because then the performing of it, I learned what kind of service, what kind of access elements were appropriate. I've only known how to make disability art by being around other disabled people. And I've only known how to do it for a particular performance because I have friends who are disabled artists, or I have people in my network who we have liberal conversations about this. I honestly don't know how to do it if you're not in community. I think there is a way in which you can broad sell, wholesale something, or kind of block aid something, but I recognize that you'll miss a part of it if you're not in community. And so I've also said that like my knowledge of disability has always come through osmosis, and that has been really key, I think, because the one thing around disability is it isn't, because it's outside of a productivity timeline, really, the way in which you understand it also can't be in a productive timeline. It can't be in a like, wow, you're going to learn 6 weeks here, or you're going to do it in 2 hour sessions, because the nature of it is to be unknowable in a productive lens. And so that's really helpful when I'm working and when I'm making work, because I'm eased at the thought of, oh, I have a deadline, like I have a deadline for this new world premiere, but then how I'm getting there is going to involve some of these principles, this disability justice principles and whatnot. I will say for everyone who's outside of the community that there is a successful scaffolding of knowledge that you can engage in. There's a relationship to disability rights, which is the understanding of rights made possible by the passing of the ADA in 1990, that gave us a kind of a Ten Commandments of what is available, what should be structurally available to people with disabilities. But then there is this kind of like meandering toward disability justice, which isn't to say that, you know, I didn't list all 10 principles, and that's key, because it's a covenant, not a commandment. You know, it's a covenant document of principles that you're going to assume your entryway. And so I think going from disability rights in this kind of didactic understanding of rights and of our history of ugly laws and of discrimination that is still very pervasive, it's really quite stunning to have that foundation to then maybe even just dip your toe into one or two principles. Then when you're engaging or otherwise exporting or producing some aspect of community work, there is a spine for you. And then I always say for others, like, I'm always interested in an authentic curiosity, right? So for like it's based on what I've experienced, the kind of relationship to that question in my script has always been really confronting. I want is your desire to just know, to kind of just claim my body in a way, or just to just have that information so that you could be more superior, you know, like, what is it for? Even, you know, I'll even say, like, when the church is really important to me as well for its, you know, for the ways that it's been creative and helped me in my own creativity. And then also really confronting in the way that I was, you know, I'd have to relinquish to a desire for my wholeness in a way that was very different, you know, or was very was compulsory and not. So what I'm just saying with all of that is, like, for every sector, I'm just curious about why do you want to know? Why do you want to be a part? And if you just have a straight answer, like, if it's just, I don't need to gain knowledge so I don't get doxxed, you know? Or if, is it because, oh, well, I think I might have a relationship to this that I didn't really recognize. You know, yeah, my work starts at home. You know, a lot of my family members still don't have a big relationship to disability in the sense that they, like, they just see it outside. If they haven't been diagnosed, then they see it outside, you know? And that's all of us, though. So my thing is, like, yeah, what's your authentic curiosity? So for folks, for teachers, for educators, for community activators, I'd say, like, yeah, disability rights is really a good place to start. Meander onto disability justice, 1-2 principles. And then what's the authentic in that you're looking for? And then find some folks that you can commune with.
As somebody who I currently don't technically, I mean, I guess I have disabilities, but I don't identify as part of the disability community. I have some, like, learning, like, as a kid, I remember having to be taken out to, like, go to the resource room, but I don't know why. It was to help me just, like, read. I was reading and then they were like, okay, you're done. I don't know why. I have no idea. But I know that, like, I know, this is what I know. I know that I can't skim. I have to read and I have to take my time in order to actually absorb. So that might be something, I don't know. And then, like, from a physical standpoint, I also don't actually identify as a person with disability, but I have things. And I know, like, my mom had, again, I don't know if she thought about it as a disability, but she had mobility issues and likely, you know, took action as part of a disabled community, but I don't think she self-identified as that. Does that make sense? And so part of the way I operate is about trying to avoid getting to that place, right? And so listening to you speak, I'm like, oh, you and actually the young woman who spoke at that event that we had this past June, where she was like, I don't know why people are so afraid. Like, we're all going to be a part of this disabled community. It was amazing how her timing was impeccable, like, should have her own show. But the way she was like, I don't know why people are like so ableist. We're all going to be a part of it. You're going to join us. Get on board. Come on in. You know, and so listening to you, like, I really appreciate what you're saying about, you know, do some learning, have some authentic curiosity, and then figure out where your in is. I know for me, my in terms of learning and where my curiosity is about, I want to support educators, and I want to make sure that kids have all the opportunities that every kid deserves, period. So to me, this was such a no-brainer for me to be a part of. And I knew it would be an opportunity for me to learn, because there was absolutely no way that I knew everything and wouldn't. But that was the other part, draw was, oh, now I'm going to, not only am I going to learn, but a whole, like, we're going to be impacting, we're going to be able to impact a whole community of folks to have different mindsets, to shift mindsets, including us. And then be able to have impact within our respective institutions that are go beyond the education-based programming, and then, you know, more field focused. So there's something really special about being invited into that world, and then my question was starting to go was about what does it mean to you when people are working towards solidarity who don't necessarily identify as being a part of the disabled community?
I love solidarity. I love the relationship to I love that people think that they want to create new communities or new connections to folks. I really feel like there's this really necessary wave of solidarity, what connections and connecting because you aren't from this community that strengthens the cord. It's important. The different and differing entryways is so important. I think the question about solidarity for the disability community is often, you know, I think that most disabled people are very skeptical of presence. And so with solidarity, it would just be about naming why you're there. You know, just like you said, like, this is my lens and my desire. And then I would say also with solidarity that, you know, much like anything, much like collaboration, not to have such a strict result in mind. I think within solidarity, there's a kind of, you're going with the flow of who you're being in solidarity with. You know, when you say I'm in solidarity with, then you often become a partner in their desires. And so that is kind of, yeah, you're latching, you are. And so, you know, being a little bit more flexible in in the timing and the product of what you will be in solidarity with.
You talked earlier about one of the principles being anti-capitalism, which is very much, you know, just output and product-based work, and how when you even as an artist, you know, there are deadlines, there are things, but like the scaffolding that needs to take place, because that, you know, we're working at the speed of trust, we're working at the speed that we need to, because there's so many layers to how one works and lives and is, you know, I think a lot of the conversation just around liberation in general. And so the intersectionality of that, you know, from a cultural American, you know, Black or other race, you know, racial perspectives and disability, like all of that is about trying to pull away from this, you know, you have to output, otherwise what, you know, what good are you? It reminds me very much of the Nap Ministry, where she's always constantly being like, take a fucking nap. Like, and it's not, but like, she's so snarky about it, but it's not, it's actually like rooted in you are, you know, we are, very many of us are the dreams of our ancestors. They couldn't even know what was possible. I was thinking about this. I saw, this is going to sound like left field, but go with me. I was watching a clip of The View where the cast of Picard, who was from the Next Generation, was on, and Whoopi was very excited because she was on the Next Generation. I'm not sure if she was in Picard, but she was very excited. And one of the things that she talked about why she really wanted to be a part of the Next Generation was, as a kid, she loved sci-fi. And so often there was no representation of Black people in what was known as what you might think of as what's the future going to be. We weren't there, is what she said. This is literally what she said. We weren't there. And then Star Trek happened, and you see, you know, Lieutenant Uhura. And I finally realized, like, oh no, we will be there. And then when this new opportunity came up, I wanted to be a part of that because I wanted that others to see, is like, we are in the future. We are the future. And the reason why I bring that up, or why I'm bringing this up now, is like, the future is not capitalism. The future is something else around liberation that I think we're all trying to go for, but it's so hard to dream it because we've been so indoctrinated in what it currently exists that to work to chisel away at pulling that away from capitalism, it's such a process, and it's so like, I'm doing it, I'm not doing it. So I'll give you a little example of how I've been trying to pull apart like this podcast. It is my creative baby. I have a great team that we work with. We meet regularly to like talk about what kinds of guests, where do we want to go? What are the big questions that we're asking ourselves? And we're supposed to be outputting monthly. And it takes work to put, there's a lot of work that goes into it. And from time to time, there's just like things that are going on in our lives between the three of us. It's like something's going on. And initially I would push, early on, I think we're in the sixth season. So like we would, or maybe at this point we're at the seventh season, but like I would push to like, we got to get this out. We said we'd do this monthly. And more recently I've been like, all right, we'll take a break this month. Okay. And it's fine. Or like something new comes out. It's like, oh, I had a plan. We're going to adjust the plan and it's okay. And we had a plan to like release on this date. Oh, that's not, you can't get it done, but that's okay. When can you get it done? And it's all about a mind shift like that. The biggest, I think that some of the biggest obstacles, going back to what you were talking about, the fear of lack, the fear, and that instead of lashing out because it actually has to do with me, the mind shift, the biggest obstacle is the mind. And when you could start working on shifting that, then there's so many other action-based things that can change, that can make ripples of impact.
When you talk about liberation, though, like, we gotta go. We gotta talk about it. Because there is no, really, for me, there is no artistry without liberation, or at least, like, without a connection, desire for liberation. I think that, yes, to your point, the imagining liberation is really complex and complexified, because all we're doing is responding to what is not, right? We're not creating anything. And so that's the, for me as an artist, I'm like, we're not creating anything. We're just saying what's not there, And it's like, no, like, let's start. And for me, it's, one of the biggest things around my practice or otherwise thinking about protest is that refusal is protest. Refusing to engage is also a thing. I mean, it doesn't seem like you're making it, you're going forward. It's really hard to feel like you're going forward by saying no to that framework, but you are making a choice. You are shifting your body, and even, for me, who loves a little bit of a gesture, that says, that's a story. So for me, I actually, because I, said I like antiquity, like, I think about what practices have been used in the past. Like, I'm looking at like, what were our ancestors doing? So if we're the dreams of our ancestors, I also feel like our ancestors are doing some stuff that we should actually like look back to and be like, yo, maybe let's pick that up again. Because one thing I'll say, and I'm developing this new project around protest culture and the relationship to it. One thing is that we do too many marches. I'm sorry. We march too much. And I would say that like our ancestors also had economic boycotts, and, we also had sit-ins. There were also ways of, negotiating our presence outside of the physical. And this is really keyed into disability, because what, our only productivity is the thing that we do for a miles, right? The exertion of a body part, or the exertion of our body, is the only symbol of liberation or protest that we're thinking about. That is already kind of a product of our immediacy culture. And our, so for me, as I'm looking at it from a different place, because I'm like, oh yeah, a march is cute and cool. It's also immediate. It's also something that you do in a certain capacity. It also has these other connotations that actually my friend Finnegan Shannon really helped me to key into as well. Sound like we march too much. So I'll say that like relationship to liberation for me is really important. And my work is actually the thing I'm trying to make liberated. When I was talking about rigidity and flow, it's definitely in how I relate to the organization or institution I'm working with. You know, the deadlines that they have for performing arts season are, they need some help. I mean, we're marketing for our piece before I've had my first rehearsal in your space. How does that work? Like, I need to have materials before I know what my, like, it's just, it's backwards. It's backwards, and it's only for the bottom line of this nonprofit, I will say. Like, I'm just like, yo, if it was Citibank, which is actually really kind of the gag, because when I become a more seasoned or more an older artist, I can command the kind of timeline I want. So I will be more a liberated artist when I'm richer. How is that possible? Like, what? That, like, we, you know, the folks that get to command whatever they want to do are in a certain echelon. And yeah, this is another conversation. That's an essay for me. But anyway, I think that, yeah, with liberation, it has to be embedded in the work. And actually, my good partner, friend, Candace Feldman, I'm a part of her. She has, like, this boutique, like, management consortium called Interim, which, you know, that's in between. And so I was, like, one of her first artists, and she has two other disabled artists on her roster. Shout out to Molly Joyce and Christopher Umpez Verde Nunez. So all of us four are kind of in this collective trying to figure out how independent artistry can be impactful, but in our vibe, you know, where we say love is a verb. And that is really important to us. And, you know, when you talk about advocacy, right, it's like when you're talking about imagination, it's like we have to create more images than less. It's almost like we got to be the AI generator, honestly. I was just, yeah. Wild. There's this new thread that's like, for 500 likes, I will make this image more patriotic, or I'll ask AI to make this image more Bavarian, or, like, you know. And then so the images are chaotic after like 500,000 likes. And similarly, though, AI, can't even get into that. I will be a Luddite for the rest of my life if AI is like the only thing we have at our disposal. I won't use electricity. But I will say, back to us, like, Interim has really been a place where I can feel like I could be an artist in my own right, creating images and creating more images. And I tell you, it's so interesting how institutions want to change, actually. Institutions want to be invited into processes that give them some breaks. They are also a conglomerate of people that are smashed underneath a system. So it's like giving a little bit of a back door or a trap door open for them. It's like it really is the Matrix, I gotta tell you.
So I like this idea of a trap door and that the nonprofit is being crushed under the complex, the industrial complex, you know? And that it's a conglomerate made of people, but people who, with what kind of imagination?
They're just susceptible. I would say they're just susceptible to it, you know? Bad intention. I think, yeah, there's BP, and then there's, you know, there's the nonprofit that, you know, hosts several different kinds of programs. You know, there's a difference, but I will say that, like, there are elements of nonprofit life that it's curious, you know?
Tell me about it. It's curious. It's very, very curious. It's so funny because I work at a nonprofit. Obviously, I've worked there for a very long time, and I'm still like, what? What is this? What's happening? I just want to do good work. What's happening? Like, can we just do good work? Ugh. Yeah. I know. I think I'm not, I don't know who I am in the nonprofit world. I don't understand who I am. I really don't. It's funny because there are people who are like, you would make a great executive director. And I'm like, would I though? I guess sometimes I feel like I'm rogue, and I watch some of these amazing, especially like executives of color who are just doing such amazing work. And I'm like, I don't think that's me, but maybe it could be, but I don't think I want to do that. That's the thing, you know, like I'm very happy in the role that I have right now. I'm very happy, but to try and figure out like a whole other system and then to have to like make that system, I don't know. And then defend that system. Yeah, I don't have the energy, the energy for that. But I am interested in learning from people who are doing that. You know what I mean? Because then I can like and sort of make it in my own little ecosystem. And one of the things that I think that when you knew me, I was absolutely like going rogue and like just not, because I wasn't in a senior management position. I was like, I was in this like just close enough, but I still had like, I was queen of my domain, you know, and there was nobody who's going to tell me how to do this because nobody else was an expert in this. Right. And so everything that we were doing, it was good for the company and it was good for the people who are participating in this work. And we're going to keep doing and getting better at this. Yeah. And I sort of like, even as a director, I also was like, okay, how do I create the kind of world that I want, like I would want to be in if I was at an entry level or a teaching artist, you know, like what does that look like within still the schema of what could feel like a more corporate setting. And I think to a certain degree, I created something that was pretty strong and its own sort of its own world within a world. The challenge though, was that world needed the strategy around creating that world was getting potentially eaten up by the culture of the whole institution. Or I don't know if it was eaten, but it was definitely afraid. And so what I'm noticing, at least in this last couple of years in terms of culture change, has been a lot more of what we've built in the education sector has to seep out and get and also get better, but like meaning the education, like even our work, like it needs time and attention and care, and it has a lot of work that it needs to keep growing and getting better and deepening and more inclusive and more socially conscious, like all of those things, reality. And yet the whole institution is starting to feel and understand that too, in a way that I just never knew was possible. And I'm very like pleased is maybe like a, not quite the right word. I mean, I feel pleased, but that I don't like that word. it's more like I'm encouraged to see the embracement of knowing that, just knowing that culture change is needed, let alone like the individuals and the composite of people really trying to move the institution forward in a positive way. But that there's still like, there's moments where like, you're like, oh crap, wow, we got to work on that. But I was saying this yesterday to my colleagues, I was like, you know, even though these issues that are being brought up and they are real, they're being brought up because they know that they can bring them up. And it's not coming at us from this combative defensive place, but like, let's shine a light on this. This is something that needs attention. Can we spend some time on this? It's an invitation, right. And a safe, you know, feeling safe to invite as opposed to protest, right? As opposed, does that make sense what I'm saying? And I'm very encouraged by that, because it means that we're doing something right. And by right, maybe that, again, that's not, I'm not trying to fix something, but it feels like we're creating something together that we all have hands in, and we all want to continue to get better in terms of working with each other, in terms of working with our constituents and our audiences, in terms of the ethos, you know, and one of the thoughts that I had is going back to a point that you made about like, it's not going to happen overnight. There's no way. Like, but if we figure out and create strategies about how to move forward so that these things can get addressed, eventually they'll become just like how we operate, right? And there's been a lot of work to lead up to how we operate now. And there'll be more work to, you know what I'm saying? And then there'll be new things that we'll need to want to like shine the light on and say, okay, here's a new thing. So it's practice and habit building. So I feel very encouraged. I think courage is definitely the right word about it, and excited to do that work and to do that with my team and with my colleagues and with people who, you know, are in our orbit, or we're in their orbit, depending, like you. That like idea around collective community building across several communities, and that interconnectedness that you were talking about, like that feels very real and very, again, encouraging. That's the best word I have right now. So you said you're an independent artist. You've got a bit of a community where you're working as a collective as well. And what are you dreaming up for yourself? What would you like to? What's the sort of next phase as you're moving into presenting as a solo artist?
I'm desiring theater, or at least this lack of silo between maybe the career that I've been really grateful for, and but I haven't felt, I'm at a place where I haven't felt like I've been using my voice in all the ways that I know I can or have or want to. So yeah, I'm thinking about like, yeah, touching on a little bit from my roots or from the places where I began. I have a full length piece in me. It's kind of an epic. And I'm excited about its prospect because again, it goes into like, what's the liberatory practice in development and devising, you know, and creating before you liberate the production team and you liberate the writing process. So yeah, I'm thinking about that right now. I'm stepping into, you know, what does it mean to give vision to another form, opera? So I'm there for a couple of years as well and thinking about this new opera. I'm thinking mostly, I guess, in general, I have this dual desire. I think it's really interesting. As you get more, I guess, noticed, there's a tendency from the industry to say that you're an expert and or say that you are, you know, the authority. And by way of how I became, you know, got into the dance field, there's still a lot that I don't have under my belt, such as it's really like having gone to a festival as a student, or having gone, you know, having done a tour somewhere here. And so I'm really still quite bright-eyed and bushy-tailed about dance as a participant, wanting to go see more things. I've just been a guest artist for Sifa Petronio, and there's another choreographer that I'm going to guest for. So it's like I'm kind of into this vibe of like just moving, kind of, you know. I'm also talking about protest, talking about refusal. You know, there's this desire about like, what are the future? I'm the future, right? Or I have this keen sense of futurity. And I don't know that I really do. I know that what I want is to have a heightened presence moving forward. I just want to increase my presence and increase my sense of being present as I'm moving forward. And also just keying into what's behind me. Really, I think my futurity is moving forward, but increasing presence and reaching back.
I love that. I love that. And I can understand why people, I get why people are like, you're an expert in things. It's honestly, you've got such a deep invitation in you. And Okay, can I just tell this story? So more recently we did a presentation, or we did like a session as part of a larger event for arts teacher, Department of Education arts teachers. And it was on a pretty challenging day globally and locally. And we were just sort of showcasing two really remarkable disabled artists. And it was in a sort of an events hall where there was these round tables, about 10 round tables around the room, and this sort of platform or the stage area with the two chairs and all that. And your our invitation to you was, could you come and like showcase your art, which would be live, and then have a conversation with the other artist. And the idea was that we were trying to showcase, like, this is what it looks like as professional disabled artists. What does that now mean for you in thinking about working with students with disabilities in your classrooms? What are the things that you could be thinking about, and what are the big questions that you have around that? You did this amazing thing that felt really impromptu, but you could have stayed on the staging area, and instead you started moving and locomoting amongst the tables. And I nearly fell out of my chair. Because I was like, I love everything. And everybody was just like, just like enthralled by the beauty of your movement, that like you talked about the flow and rigidity, but it all seems right and beautiful and stunning, and it draws you in. And the fact that you were like, I'm not creating a distance, I'm with you, I'm a part of you, we are a community. It was a beautiful choice, a stunning choice.
Thank you. It's actually reflective of like the moment I'm in. I'm just responding. And it's hard to say that, because I was really grateful for that moment, because it's literally helped me understand how to do that in spaces that I've been doing work recently. Like, I've been at the, I did the rooftop of the Met Museum, and then I just took over the Guggenheim Rotunda for like 2 hours. So yeah, but like, it was there. It was like in that, you know, that give presentation that, you know, you just start to key into what can you do, you know? And I understand those moments as melting moments. And yeah, that's my invitation. I think out of everything that I do, that's my invitation. It's to be close, to be connected, to separate. And you're right, it was a little impromptu too, but I think that we were both looking at each other really like, this, we need something else. We need something today, you know, which I think it's only by the permission of those who are in your partnership, you know?
Absolutely. And it became for me, yeah, like a symbol of how, what you just talked about, the we are connected, we are together. It's the invitation. It was just a beautiful visual of something that I wasn't at the time able to articulate. I've tried to do so here.
Being around Give too has been really exciting from the outset, just because it's like, it has kind of it's engaged me on all of my parts, you know? So thankful for that. Like, I was a adjudicator, you know, researcher, writer. I have been a talker. I have been a performer. Like, I'm like, okay, thank you, Give.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be more opportunities, because it's a growing movement. and it's very positive for I find it's positive for everybody who's involved, all the participants, to hear it being talked about. Like, there's just like, there's a beautiful thing that's happening, and it's important. Well, Sharon, you are a delight and a light and a joy. And I'm really excited about watching and potentially being a part of any part of your future. because I just, you have such a, you're so embedded in so much like positive memories of a time that actually wasn't that positive for me. And to have watched how your growth, you know, lovingly, like from afar, and then getting closer again with you over because of something that felt like a real tangible, clear opportunity for community building, has been just the, like one of the greatest parts of my career.
Deep gratitude for you. Oh, you are so loved, and you're very appreciated by me. Wow, what a gift. Similarly, to be close and near and in expanding elastic ways that it's been really exciting. Thank you for today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, we'll be in touch. You know what I mean? Like, we'll be in touch. Yeah, we'll be in touch. I'm probably going to email you tomorrow. I don't know. No, honestly, I'm so pleased that people are going to be able to hear you on this platform, at least, because I know that they hear you in many platforms. But yeah, no, thank you so much for sharing. Thank you for helping me, you know, learn some things too, honestly, and giving me some more things to think about and more, you know, stuff that I need to start reading and learning, like gain my own scholarship.
Ooh, me too. I'm reading up a storm these days. Oh, it's been great. I thank you so much. This has been so wonderful. Your platform is so beautiful to like dip into. This has been such a wonderful experience.
Thank you for listening to episode 68, Act 2 of Teaching Artistry with Courtney J. Boddy, Jerron Herman, Pockets of Light. Join us next time for a conversation with Adam Odsis Rubin. This podcast is edited and produced by Ben Weber. Christopher Totten is the director of creative content. Jonna Waldman wrote and performed the theme song. Tim Palin designed the logo. Visit us at www.teachingartistry.org and head to the pod shop at the top of the page for merch. Find us on Instagram at Teaching Artistry Podcast and on YouTube. Check out the Teaching Artistry with Courtney J. Boddy channel and watch We Can't Go Back. Like our page on Facebook, listen to us on SoundCloud and Spotify, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to share this podcast with all the teaching artists in your life.
Let's start it up now. Let's start it up now. Ooh.